May it please the Court, Tracy Dressner for Petitioner Leif Taylor. This case really presents a straightforward question. In 2004, this Court reversed Mr. Taylor's conviction and issued a conditional writ that said, if he gets retried, it has to be with evidence other than the illegally obtained confession. And in the second retrial, the one that resulted in Mr. Taylor's current conviction, a prosecution witness said that Mr. Taylor had confessed.
Didn't say he confessed to the police.
He did not.
And there was other evidence, disputed, but there was other evidence that he made statements, confessions to, statements that could be viewed as confessions, and...
There is, but I think there's sort of a layperson belief that confession involves something of legal significance and certainly something different than what had been presented so far. At that point in the trial, Lucero was only the second prosecution witness, was that back in 1994, Lucero had said that Mr. Taylor had gotten in the van and said, I just shot the fool, let's go. And let's say that you have a group of teens that were involved in whatever was going on that night. Saying that is not a confession. That's a, let's get me out of here. That's not what a lay person would think of as a confession. We live in an age of...
What about Mr. Elliott? That's way after the time, the events. Might a lay person consider those statements at that time confessing to the crime?
Well, two responses to that. One is at the point that this occurred in the trial, Elliott hadn't testified yet. And putting aside all the weirdness related to what Elliott claimed happened, again, that's not a confession. Conveys with it some aura of legal importance. Not something you say to somebody that you know, an acquaintance, when you're walking to get ice cream at the 7-Eleven. Confession to a lay person implies something involving the police or something involving your priest. It's a stronger word than that. And really at the core, though, is that there was a simple order from this court. Don't bring in the confession. All the court had to do at the point when this was done was declare a mistrial. It was only the second witness. The relevance was that Mr. Taylor was entitled to a fair trial that didn't have this aura of the confession, and that wasn't what happened. And what's actually even more disturbing about how it played out with the denial of the mistrial was the next day when they were still debating what to do, the prosecutor comes in, and the first thing the prosecutor says to the court is, a denial of a mistrial, it's reviewed for an abuse of discretion. All you have to do is not be arbitrary and capricious. Then there's a little back and forth, and then the judge says, I've thought long and hard about what I'm going to do, and my decision is not arbitrary and capricious. What they were doing, and then proceeds to say that, parrot back exactly what the prosecutor had said. And so the point wasn't to try and ensure that Mr. Taylor had a fair trial or to ensure that the court was complying with what this court's mandate had been. It was to try and protect the going forward with the trial and not wasting other resources. Or as the court said, well, if we had another retrial, Lucero would do it again. Well, that's not Mr. Taylor's issue. Mr. Taylor's entitled to a fair trial. If they have a witness they can't control, he shouldn't have to be subjected to a trial where the confession comes in.
There's no suggestion that the prosecution manipulated this somehow, right?
Well, not directly. Certainly indirectly. When we start...
Yeah, I know you sort of tried to write that between the lines, but...
Well, I mean...
I don't see any evidence of that.
Well, I respectfully disagree. There's two issues. One is it's uncontroverted that before the first retrial, that prosecutor, and this was the same prosecutor for all the trials, that this prosecutor told Lucero, if you don't give us the same testimony that you gave initially, that Taylor got in the van and said, I shot the guy, we're going to charge you with murder. That's a pretty heavy thing to tell somebody. And then expect that they're not going to say exactly what you wanted them to say. But the other thing is you cannot read what transpired with Lucero's testimony at the second retrial and not think that this was coercion and badgering of a witness. The judge took it upon herself to decide what the truth was, to decide that Lucero wasn't providing the truth, and jails him for 4 days. And then he comes back to court, and this prosecutor's badgering him unrelentlessly. And he keeps saying,
Not the truth about what happened on the ground at the time of the crime or the time of the events. What the judge said is, you're lying when you're saying you don't remember.
But this wasn't
any way coercion. I mean, he could have said, okay, I do remember, and Leif Taylor didn't say that to me.
And that's the truth that I
meant. As far as the pressure from the judge is concerned, the judge just didn't believe he was...
That he didn't remember.
We went there. I'm inclined to think that she got it right on that.
Well, but we don't know, and it seemed to me, and this wasn't an issue, unfortunately.
Well, I mean, I remember things considerably further back than 13 years. It's not 13 years isn't that long a time, and it's hard to believe that if he remembered the facts of the first trial, he remembered the facts of the second trial, he now for the third trial he didn't remember. I mean, I certainly. It's hard to disagree with a judge or say that's an abuse of discretion for her to say, look, I think you're lying. I'm going to jail you until you stop pretending that you don't remember.
Well, it's also hard to disagree with Lucero's point that there had been so many different versions told that he wasn't sure what was the truth.
I find it considerably easier to disagree with that than I do with disagreeing with the judge. I mean, you know,
But the fact still remains that Lucero was jailed for 4 days, and that he was, while he was expressing concern on the second day of his testimony after being jailed for 4 days, about wanting to see his daughter, not having gotten fed, not being concerned that no matter what he said, he was going to be jailed again, that the prosecutor kept asking him the same questions over and over and insisted that he was responsible for the death.
You don't have a claim here based on the prosecutor, on the pressure that the prosecutor put on the witness, right?
You do not. This is just background information to how the.
I mean, I can sort of understand. I'm not saying you should have raised it or anything else, but I understand the nature of that claim. The witness is being pressured to lie, but you're not raising that claim. I'm not sure where it would go, but I understand the claim. But once you get past that point, I just don't see where you. I mean, I'm just speaking for myself, but I just don't see where if a judge is sitting there and believes a witness is trying to escape testifying by pretending, she thinks he's pretending to not remember, when that is not a legitimate function for the judge to perform. There's nothing out of the ordinary or improper or irregular. I mean, that's what one of the reasons judges are there, to make sure the witnesses don't escape testifying by pretending not to lie.
Well, and I don't want to get
pretending not to remember.
I don't want to get sidetracked on that issue because it's really only a collateral issue. It was presented to give context.
You raise it, and I'm trying to sort of peel back the onion. I don't think that's an issue at all because
let's come back to the issue. The issue is this court's order didn't say that a confession could come in indirectly or that the confession could be mentioned but the details not be given or that the confession could come in and the jury could be told to disregard it. The court's order was pretty clear. You got to be convicted on evidence other than the illegally obtained confession. The witness testified that well, Taylor
confessed. Let's accept that was, in fact, our order. I mean, I don't think we're as explicit as you would like us to have been, but there it is. But stuff happens at trial. The judge here immediately stopped the trial, gave a curative instruction, told the jury to disregard, and so on. And we have a presumption in our law, which I'm sure is reflected in California law as well, that juries follow instructions. So why is it not the case that we have to treat this as a trial with a confession? You know, the reference to the confession is not in the record because the judge told the jury disregard it. Why isn't that, in fact, in conformance with our order?
Because as we all know, and as the United States Supreme Court has said, confessions can't really be flushed out of jurors' minds once they hear it. And again, you have to look at the circumstances in the way this came in. As soon as he said
you remember the confessions the Supreme Court has held are not are subject to harmless error review. What is that, Fully Love? I forget the name.
Arizona versus Fulminante.
There we go. Right.
But the way you have to, this was red flagged for the jury. He says, you know, why are you doing this to me? He's already confessed. Just leave me alone. Judge immediately calls the jury out, sends them out. Judge, the attorneys in the court talk for a while. Court calls the jury back in, sends them home. Then the first thing that happens when they come in the next morning, again, there's a lot of attorney stuff. The juror finally come in, and the first thing the judge says to them is, disregard anything that was said about a confession. Well, talk about red lights, flashing lights. How could the jury not be thinking confession, that this was something critical? And we also have to think of the context.
There's another way to look at it. He used the word confession. That has some legal connotation. And when she comes back with this instruction, it says, you decide what's a confession or an admission. I thought it was actually kind of a clever way to do this, to throw admission in there with confession. So couldn't the jury just have been thinking that, oh, something wrong happened because they called this statement of Lucero's, or that Lucero made about all these things that people were saying, a confession?
Well, I suppose you could think of it that way, but again, context is everything in this case. You can't disregard that this jury knew that the murder happened in 1993 and that Leif Taylor was arrested in 1993 and that there had been multiple proceedings. And it would not take a very much leap to figure out that this was a retrial. And why might there be a retrial with these red flag confessions? It doesn't take a law degree to think that maybe there was a confession that we're not supposed to know about. And we don't know what exactly the jury would have thought. But there was a simple solution given this court's order. Grant the mistrial. Grant the mistrial. Let's not worry about it. I mean, that's exactly what did Taylor's attorney say? We couldn't, if there had been a bigger error that could have occurred, I couldn't imagine it. This is exactly what we were all concerned about. The judge knew it. The judge had instructed multiple times, don't say anything about the confession.
Here's a bigger error. The policeman's on the stand and he says he confessed to me. I can imagine a bigger error.
Well, that second biggest then, but pretty close. I'm going to, unless there's further questions, I'm going to reserve some time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll hear from the warden.
Good morning, Your Honors. Deputy Attorney General Louis Carlin for respondent, and may it please the court. The initial claim that we were talking about fails for three reasons. And the first is that there was no confession admitted at trial. The parties were aware of the problem and had taken every step they could to avoid that. And the court's curative instructions was a very reasonable exercise of discretion in order to ensure a fair trial. Then the question is...
So this is an entirely witness case, right? There's no physical evidence.
Correct, Your Honor.
So a confession winds up being... You know, when you've got physical evidence, you've got physical evidence, and but conflicting reports, conflicting witnesses, and that kind of situation, the idea that the defendant confessed is pretty big stuff.
Correct, Your Honor. So the reason that the curative instructions made sense here is that the statement was quick, fleeting, and immediately, the court instructed the jury not to consider it. The statement was confession, and at the time Lucero made that statement, he had already testified that when petitioner got back in the van, he said, "I shot the fool." So we do have an admission there, and that is something that the jury was legitimately entitled to consider. So the court carefully balanced these considerations and said, you know, I could just say don't consider it at all. And the basic instructions that the deliberations must be based entirely on evidence. This is an evidence. You have to act as if you did not hear it. But the court did more than that. The court took cognizance of the fact that two admissions had already come into evidence, because there was one, the prior witness, Leyva, who testified that petitioner had admitted the crime. So what the court did was say, you know, you heard the word confession. Confession is a term of art, and I'm going to tell you how to understand it. Here's the difference. Here's an admission, and here's a confession, and you jurors are the ones who determine what is a confession.
Counsel, I just want to clarify one thing. You indicated there was no physical evidence. This may not be the strongest evidence, but I thought the 22 caliber bullets recovered from the petitioner's home were introduced into evidence.
They were, Your Honor. Okay. So we do know that the victim was killed by two gunshots, two 22 caliber bullets, and yes, but nothing tying him.
Sure.
That's as close as we got.
Yes. There were...
Yeah, and they were found in the garage, and nothing belonging to the defendant was near these bullets in the garage, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
I would say, though, you can really think of three sources of evidence in this case, so it's not just statements, because you have the eyewitness testimony that very strongly puts... Rodriguez at the scene, and at the scene in the company of another young male. So we know he's there, and that's very strong. So then you have the second source of evidence, which would be the statements from the people in the van. And the van...
I'm sorry, let me just go back to your first statement. I thought that this is offshore. We're talking about the... am I pronouncing the name right? Or
Off-Gang, O-F-G-A-N-G, I believe.
Okay, Off-Gang. And didn't he at some point testify that he thought the second male was Hispanic?
He did, at the first trial.
But not at the second trial.
The thing about Off-Gang was that he never really saw the second assailant very well. It's very clear he never saw his face in full.
I see.
So he did call him an Hispanic. He absolutely. At the second trial, he tried
but
to
I guess it must
that.
Might have been because he sees one. He definitely saw the other Rodriguez, right?
Rodriguez.
And I gather he looks Hispanic, so he may have simply associated.
Indeed. That's a likely explanation.
But in any event, he doesn't say Hispanic at the trial we're now considering.
No, he tries to back away from that. And he says, you know, when I said that the first time, I didn't mean a dark-skinned Hispanic. I think the fact
I meant a light-skinned, blue-eyed Hispanic.
Exactly. Yes. Well, indeed. And the jury could listen to those discrepancies and make up their mind. But I think the key fact is he didn't see the second assailant well enough to determine race. And Hispanic is a very broad term, so it's not as if we can do a sort of a mathematical problem and say...
No, but that's a different issue. The question that there are Hispanics who might be, you know, blonde and blue-eyed, I think the idea is when somebody says he looks Hispanic, they probably mean somebody who looks sort of the typical Hispanic, dark-eyed, somewhat dark-skinned, which is saying he looks Hispanic is a shorthand way of saying... he has those characteristics, right?
That's right. And my point is that on the one hand, you have the clear identification of Rodriguez, and you have a hazy identification of the second person. He never saw the face full on. It was dark. The lighting was by street lamp and headlights. So I just don't think you can put that much stock into it.
But you were relying on that. You said there were three sources of evidence.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
And that one source is very weak. He's not only somebody who didn't see him full face, he saw him with hazy light, and in some ways misidentified him first time as Hispanic, right?
Oh, absolutely. I'm not using that first source to identify him as an eyewitness ID. I think absolutely not. Okay. I think all we know is that, but we're very clear,
it's
Rodriguez
a man.
Was
it's,
there
right.
and with someone else.
Right.
Okay, so that's all I'm saying from that source.
And a male, likely a male.
Right. Slim build, young. He got that right both trials.
Or at least consistent.
He was consistent on some things. Okay. And so then you have that one source. The second is the people in the van saying Rodriguez and petitioner got out of the van and walked in the direction of the murder scene just before the gunshots. We picked them up just after the gunshots together. So that's source number two. So that's pretty strong circumstantial evidence saying that the second person was petitioner. And then finally, you have the admissions. And we have five witnesses who testified as to admissions by petitioner, three in the van and the two... Elliot and Leyva, who saw him the night after and the day after.
Did the urine evidence come in the third trial?
The
urine?
Urine.
Oh, the urine. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Our words are very difficult for me.
No, I
could use the other word, but...
Okay, all right.
We're on the air, so I think I better...
that same evidence came.
It did come in.
It did, yes.
Okay.
Same source. I'm pretty sure. Well, actually, at the first...
I get confused with the trial, so
I thought Bonilla said something about this. Was it Bonilla?
Bonilla did, and she testified at the first trial. She was the only person from the van who testified at the first trial. So the urine also came in through... The testimony concerning it only came in through her and others. I believe Rodriguez, at least Rodriguez.
Okay. So you are claiming no error, harmless error? What exactly is the state's position?
As to the first argument that there was a violation of the court's mandate, we're saying there simply was none. As to an ADPA violation of the ADPA standard for this inappropriate statement coming in, we're saying under this court's decision in Hayes, essentially the same approach. The first question would be, is there a clearly established Supreme Court precedent? And as the court said in Hayes, there probably isn't. This is a lot like Holly versus Yarbrough, where we don't have... We have an abuse of discretion standard to which we must defer, but then we have what's the constitutional error? And the closest you can come to is a violation of one's right to a fair trial under Estelle v. McGuire. Probably too general. And that's what the court said in Hayes. But then alternatively, it said, okay, were the curative instructions sufficient to ensure a fair trial? And we assess that under the AEDPA's discretionary standard. So I would say the trial court, in exercise of its discretion, reasonably gave curative instructions that the Court of Appeal in California could reasonably determine protected petitioner's rights to a fundamentally free trial.
Okay, thank you. You had a little time left for rebuttal. We'll give you a total of 2 minutes.
Not one person at that trial testified that Taylor ever said anything in the van. This trial, the second trial, was completely based on statements that were made back in 1994 that the witnesses either disavowed or and explained how the police had set them up and gotten them instructed them to say that Taylor was the one who had said that in the van. And indeed, Lucero and Bonilla testified about the witnesses all getting together because Hispanics stick together to make sure that their stories meshed. As I described in my brief, it is a completely reasonable scenario that exactly what was testified to happened. But if you substituted one of the Hispanic, slightly taller and larger males that were in that van that day, say Alan Meister or Abel, who we know nothing about, and said substituted Taylor for that person, you'd have the exact same trial and we'd be sitting here talking about their conviction. This was based on statements made by teenagers 13 years before the 13 years earlier. Nobody testified at this trial. They disavowed their statements. Even Bonilla disavowed it. The statement that Bonilla claimed that Taylor had said that came in through the police officer who very fluently explained how Bonilla had said that Taylor had said this. This was the same police officer who had no memory about Taylor's confession that this court found had engaged in unfair police practices regarding the same case. We have Rodriguez testifying that the officers told him what to say when he said his statement. And who were those officers? The same ones that this court said had engaged in unfair police practices with regard to Taylor's confession. And these are the witnesses, and this is the situation in which we're going to rely upon for the sanctity of Mr. Taylor's murder conviction, for which he may very well spend the rest of his life in prison. It seems a little weak to me. And when you going back to the confession issue, there was a simple solution to comply with this court's mandate. All the court had to do was grant the mistrial. They were only two witnesses into the trial, and instead the court set it up solely to protect her decision from appellate review by claiming she wasn't being arbitrary and capricious, by relying on, well, if we tell the juries to disregard it and juries are presumed they have to disregard it, we've cured it. It just is so, and because Lucero would, if we did it again, if we had retried it, he would do it again. Those were the three reasons that she gave for denying the mistrial. We have the United States Supreme Court, as I said, saying that confessions can't be erased from somebody's mind, even if you instruct them to do so. And Mr. Taylor should not be serving the rest of his life in prison because they feared that they had a witness that was out of control. That's a trial problem. That's a prosecution problem. It's not a fairness issue related to Mr. Taylor's entitlement to a fair trial. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Case is argued. We'll stand submitted. We are adjourned.